There's so many Marvel titles that have come out since I stopped reading Marvel comics. I can't keep straight, like Thunderbolts, and then there's the one where it's like the kids of the supervillains, which I did actually read.
Runaways.
Runaways, right? And then there's like, I don't know, I feel like there's a lot of these sort of like spin-off teams that, like, if they didn't exist in the 90s or the early 2000s, I don't know who they are.
Right. Well, I mean,
We're elder millennials plus, you know? So, like, if it didn't exist in the 90s, it functionally doesn't exist, you know? Like,
I mean, it's like we're rapidly approaching the point where your Simpsons references just fall flat. You know,
oh, I
people
don't make Simpsons references anymore. No one gets them.
used to be able to communicate exclusively in Simpsons references, similar to that episode of Star Trek: The Next Generation, where,
Also, our 90s reference, by the way.
yes,
Yes, that's
exactly.
true.
And like
Getting a bit
only
meta.
everyone see like all of the Gen Alphas right now that are listening to this podcast are just like, I don't understand any of the words that that guy just said.
Considering how much time I spend around Gen Alphas, like I also don't get any of their references. I still don't know what Skibidi Toilet is, and it's
Oh,
already over by the time my students
yeah.
heard of
And
it.
at this
It's
point,
not
I'm
cool
too afraid
anymore.
to ask. I heard they're making a movie about that, and it's going to be Michael Bay directed.
That is
Yeah.
not a movie for me. That's all I know.
Okay, but because I had to know, and I looked it up, and it was actually a really fascinating, like, story of like how it came to be. But then I was at the end of it, I'm like, no, but how do you can't make that into a movie. Like, that doesn't make any sense,
See, I think
especially
the
Michael
key is
Bay.
Michael Bay can't make that into a movie.
Right. But it's like, it from what I understand, it's like it's all like l lore built on itself. So it's like if you weren't there at the beginning, like you wouldn't understand where it is now because you have to sort of have been involved in the whole progression.
Yeah, but I'm sure they'll do something just kind of interpretive based.
Yeah, I mean, you could say the same thing about X-Men. X-Men doesn't make any sense unless you were there from the beginning.
Or
Like,
like
people still
Pirates
figured
of
out
the
how to make movies of
Caribbean.
it.
Pirates of the Caribbean is like, it's not the story of the ride. It's like just taking the vibes of this ride and then building whole new lore around it. So I'm sure there's a way, whether or not it will get me into a theater, I think probably no.
Right.
You realize
Yes.
that now that we've spent so much time talking about Skibidi Toilet, I'm going to have to include it in the list of things we mentioned
That's right.
on episode.
We can't. We're not the arbiters of culture. We can't control what is or is not popular.
No.
If it
There's
was
like
up to us,
there's 7 billion other people who get a
different
say in
world.
that.
Is the sign that like the world is changing. There was a really good J I don't know if I'm on the I'm on TikTok a lot, and I follow Jason Pargan, who used to be one of the writers at Cracked. And he does really good TikTok videos, and he had a whole one about the Skibidi Toilet thing, and he was basically just like, yeah, I know it's hard to see the old world die and a new world rise up, but this is where we're at. Like, you will not understand Skibidi Toilet, but Skibidi Toilet is now going to become
Skibidi Toilet understands you.
the thing.
Skibidi Toilet died for all your sins, whether you believe in it or not.
Well, this episode's not getting monetized.
Not all our episodes are monetized. We're doing this for fun. There is no Skibidi Toilet sponsorship available to us.
I mean, like, okay, so just to get off this, I was at the Comic Jam last night, and it was a lot of fun. Actually, Ed Brisson made a guest appearance because he's
Oh.
down for a wedding. At some point, I was mentioning that my partner was at her book club, and then somebody was like, "Oh, you know what would be fun is to do like a graphic novel book club." And I was like, yeah, that would be fun. You get together with your friends and talk about graphic novels. And then I was like, wait a minute. No, I'm in a podcast. That's exactly what I'm doing. I'm doing that tomorrow.
But I've been thinking about this lately, actually. Like, I read in the paper, I read on some blog, not the literal paper, about a new type of book club that they have in bars now. where they'll like they host it in a bar and they have like basically a cocktail hour where you all go and instead of just discussing the book in like a formal circle, it's like you all go out to hang out and read the book at the same time and have these like casual discussions. And I thought, like, wouldn't that be a fun thing to do with like a stack of manga, right? Like a just everyone brings like three or four tankobon to a cafe and you just sit there like trading them around and discussing what it's about. And I think that could be cool.
I think that would maybe even work better than with prose because comics are a faster read. Like you could
Yeah.
read a manga like from start to finish, like within a coffee shop session.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh
Yeah.
man. I think I've recently determined that I can gauge my enjoyment of a comic by the speed in which I complete it, because I borrowed a couple graphic novels from the library, and like one of them was like a DC Vertigo title. I can't even remember the name of it now, but it was sort of like this, you know, edgy, these like mystery solving gang of misfits in England, and like it's got lots of like sex and violence, and like we're definitely breaking the comics code, and there's like voodoo magic and, you know, other questionable things, and like I don't know, I was like, man, this is a really thin graphic novel and I've still only got halfway through it. And then in comparison, like I picked up Jellyfish, which is like three times as thick as this Vertigo book, and I just like plowed through it in like an afternoon and just finished it. And I was like, oh, you know, like I think I need to just stop with this other graphic novel because, like, clearly there's a part of me that's just not having a good time and is slowing this whole process down. Where, like, if I'm enjoying it, I'm gonna fire through it like really
Yeah.
quick.
I finally picked it up at Bandcamp. I'd been waiting for it a long time, the Jellyfish, and I ended up reading it before I got home.
All right, I guess we're talking about jellyfish. That's our episode.
Yeah, that's it. Thanks for coming, everyone. We've been the Trade Waiters. It's been cool. But no, of course, let's talk about the jellyfish. So, thank you guys for agreeing to read this one. I'll give a little bit of an introduction to the book first. This is a story by Boom, which is another great segue for toilets. So, Boom is an artist from Quebec. And so, she's been doing a lot of her work in the Québécois BD scene. And what I find is really interesting is that the French comics market in Quebec, it seems like they don't even generally bother translating even their most popular works. They just go straight for the French market in France. They have like a much tighter connection with obviously the French-speaking world. And so there's this whole ecosystem community of really talented graphic novelists in Quebec that have been kind of isolated to the French market this whole time and building their own genre. And the Jellyfish, so the Pow Pow Press is the one who published this one. The Jellyfish is part of kind of an initial imprint, an initial foray where they're trying to take some of these Quebecois artists and actually break into the North American English-speaking market now. And I think that's tremendously exciting because, you know, comics, I love comics, I love BD. I always wanted to see more BD translated here anyway, and to have our fellow Canadians as well. So yeah, also to start full disclosure, so I am a supporter of Boom on Patreon. We are mutuals. I consider her a friend, but I couldn't put that word in her mouth. And so I've been following Boom's work for a really long time. She's been a part of the webcomic space, and still is with her comic Boomery, which is an ongoing autobiographical strip comic about her life with her husband and two daughters. And it's a really interesting, I find it just interesting for that alone that there aren't a lot of family comics from the voice of the mom. I mean, there's like, for better or worse, but I feel like in general, it's not something we see as often. And so I really like it for that. Boom had a graphic novel before this, which was A Small Revolution. So I believe this is her second full graphic novel. In French, it's La Méduse, and it's been already collecting a lot of accolades in the French-speaking world. So in 2023, it was nominated for the Prix Livre-Addict and the Prix BD Québec, but it won the BD Causa Grand Prix. It won the Prix BD du Salon du Livre de Trois-Rivières. And this year, it won the Prix de Librairie de Québec, Prix BD des Collégiens, Prix de la Critique ACBD de la Bande Dessinée Québécoise. So it's just been like racking up a lot of accolades. And for reasons that I think we'll understand as we come through our discussion. So yeah, as a high-level overview of the book, it follows a character named Odette. They live in Montreal and they are dealing with their life as a 20-something as they are slowly losing their vision to a condition that's not medically named, but is having a jellyfish appear in your eye and slowly grow and multiply until their vision is completely obscured. And since this book starts in an optometrist's office, I thought I would keep things light and start our character building questions because we are all bespectacled. When did you first discover that you needed glasses, and what was that experience like for you?
Good question. That's a perfect question for this context. I'm JD. I first needed glasses. I guess it would have been like late middle school, early high school. And I realized I couldn't see, I wasn't able to read things like at the front of the classroom, or like if we were at a fast food place, I couldn't see the menu. I must need glasses. So what's ironic is, when I was much younger than that, I had these like plastic glasses frames with no lenses in them that I would wear just for fun. I guess I felt like it suited my personality to look like a nerd.
It was an innate part of you. It's hard to imagine you without glasses, so it's fine.
I can't imagine myself without glasses. I never draw myself without glasses. So yeah, like when I needed glasses, I'm like, yeah, okay, sounds good. I've never had any interest in getting contacts. Partly because like I don't want to touch my eyes, that's gross, no thank you, but also just because like I see myself as someone with glasses, so that's part of who I am.
So I'm Jeff Ellis, and yeah, I mean, I similarly feel strange when I don't have glasses on. I've had glasses since I was maybe around 12 years old, I'm gonna think. I was like probably around grade six, grade seven, and it started only in my left eye. So I remember just like closing an eye and being like, oh, this eye is blurry, this eye is fine. And so my first pair of glasses had a prescriptive lens and a glass lens. And just this will be a message for all the kids is like, I used to stay up late reading at night, and the light was on the right-hand side. So I had light, more light on this side of my face. And my left side was in shadow. And so, I mean, I don't know, whatever. I haven't really talked to an optometrist about this, but like, it's my belief that I had more strain on my left eye because it was in the darker, shadowier part. The light was hitting things more on the right-hand side. So I think probably I would have ended up needing glasses anyways, but like, my left eye is significantly worse than my right eye. And I think some of that was straining my eyes reading at night with poor lighting. So everyone have a really well lit room when you're reading.
No flashlights under the covers.
Take care of your eyes.
Yeah. I've read a few articles that say that there's actually like a growing epidemic of myopia worldwide because of how much time we spend with our focal length being right in front of us, basically, and less looking out in the world. So you're not alone. I
I think
actually
that's where the stereotype of nerds wearing glasses comes from,
probably.
based on reality, at least loosely
Yeah,
based.
some reality, but we're all nerds now. So I came to glasses like relatively later in life. So I never had glasses growing up. I had perfect 20/20 vision, but something that runs in my family is that in our early adulthood. So like in my 20s, like it happened the exact same way to my dad in his 20s, is that like the shape of our eyeball like spontaneously changed and like created an astigmatism. So I didn't realize this. Like I was through university, I was in the workforce, and I realized that my posture was really bad when I was working on all these spreadsheets with reams and reams of data. Like I was always like way up close to the computer trying to read this data, and it's really hurting my neck. And so I finally isolated it to my vision being the problem. And I got glasses. And yeah, I really like wearing glasses. I think it also suits my personality. So even though I can get by throughout my day without them, like I tend to wear them all the time. Also, that's the recommendation of my optometrist anyway. Anyway, I'm Jam. And now let's talk about the jellyfish.
Yeah, this was a really good book. Like Pow Pow Press had a table at Van Caff, and that was the first I'd heard of them. And they had like a whole bunch of graphic novels out on their table, and like the guy who was there gave me the pitch for the publisher, how they're like publishing in Montreal and like translating books, publishing in two languages, and like such a good premise for a publisher. Like I was excited about it as soon as I first heard about it. I can't remember what book it was that I bought that day because I have not finished reading all my Van Caff books. Yeah, when I picked up this one, I was like, wow, this is really good. I'm so glad that Pow Pow was out there translating books because there's no way I would have read it otherwise. My French is terrible.
And it's like, even if your French is okay, like it's a whole different community to I struggle with this with BD from France as well. Like I have a hard time hearing about these books because it's a different media ecosystem as well.
I mean, I remember looking at this book at Van Cleef and wanting to buy it, but I'd already spent enough money. So I'm glad that this gave me a reason to finally pick that up. But I didn't know the story of Pow Pow Press, and I know listening to the introduction you gave, Jam, it really makes me just think about something that's very Canadian about how Quebec, being this very unique province with French language at its core, has such a strong cultural industry where they have such unique and specific music and television and movies, and like there's such rich culture because it's this distinctive like voice where like yes they're speaking French but it's culturally distinctive from something from France, and it has a lot of government support. Like the Quebec government wants there to be a strong Quebec culture so that they can establish themselves as this distinct society, right? And it always, as a English speaking, as an Anglo-Canadian artist, it always makes me jealous because like I wish that there was even a 10% of the same investment in English speaking Canadian culture, that we take it for granted that, well, you know, it's okay. Like, you know, but then it's like you've got to battle it out with all of this media coming up from the southern border, right? It's so much harder as a Canadian musician, comic book artist, TV, if you're competing against all this American content, where like in Quebec, it's like you're more getting integrated into the bande dessinée scene in Europe. Like that's actually like a boon, right? And I don't know, it's I've, I that, sorry, this is like a tangent, but like man, I wish Canadian English artists could get some of the same kind of supports that like French Canadian artists get.
Yeah, I mean it does goes to show that like this type of support does make a difference. I think it's also very different. I mean, Pow Pow has, or I've read online from Boom and such that Pow Pow has actually been struggling to break into the North American market of comics because, like, as a market, I think it's struggling a little bit. Like, it's harder, as we all know, to make a living as an English writer of comics. The field isn't as respected as it is in the French language. It isn't as it's not considered part of like adult culture as well. I think it's still trying to establish itself that way of like, oh, this is just like a book that we would read like any other book. Whereas in French culture, it seems a little bit more already established, accepted, understood. So if an adult graphic novel about, 20 somethings living their life appears in France, there's already a ready market that understands how to interact with a product like that. Whereas in North America, we're still working on it, It's like, I feel like we're finally beyond like bam pow, comics aren't for kids anymore, but I still feel like we have a ways to go. And so it's frustrating that there's so much good work out there that is still struggling to get traction.
I mean, this is a great tangent. I love this tangent, but we should talk about the book too.
Yes.
Yeah, it's a really it's just I mean, to start with, it's just like really well drawn. Like I really like this style. It's like got a lot of like the detailed backgrounds feel like really important. It gives it a really, really strong sense of place. Like I've never been to Montreal. I can tell just by like flipping through the book. This is set in Montreal. And the premise too is like so smart. The idea that because like if I were given the pitch, you have to write a comic where the main character is like slowly losing their vision. How do you draw that? I don't know what I would do. That's a difficult thing to undertake. But the having the sort of the jellyfish just kind of floating around, following Odette through life, and then multiplying, and then slowly becoming a cloud of jellyfish, and then becoming nothing but jellyfish, like that, you get that immediately. Like even compared to like if you just had like blotches of ink. Like a blotch of ink, you don't know what that is. It's like, could be like a mistake on the page for all you know. But a jellyfish is like when you see it, you think of it as like something that floats around and moves. So it's the perfect representation of what the main character is seeing.
I think the way that was done was really clever. I made a note to myself that at the beginning, you sort of forget that the jellyfish are there. And it's like that's kind of Odette's experience, right? It's like, oh, there's this jellyfish, but I've got to live my life. And it's like they're constantly in frame, but you kind of start to ignore them until you can't anymore, until they become, there's so many of them that now you can't not notice them. And it's like, I'm sure that's also Odette's experience, right?
And on my reread, I did like appreciate how it's in every single frame with Odette. Like it's never omitted. And it's like it's not usually front and center. It's not usually like the subject of the panel happening, but it is ever present. And I loved how it has a little bit of a personality with it as well. It seems like Odette almost starts to have a relationship with this new part of their life. And it reminds me, like you said, JD, like the jellyfish metaphor. I'm sure like this is probably a real condition. I didn't look it up. I'm sorry. But and it makes sense, like if you can imagine if you've ever had a floater in your eye, and the way that if you look at the floater, it seems to like go away. Or like if you focus on something, it tends to like come back into that in a really strange and frustrating way. And so the way it was illustrated really reminded me of that as well.
Man, that was, I think, where this story really hooked me in, because when the optometrist is like, oh, you've got a jellyfish in your eye, it reminded me of when I was like 32 and noticing this like floater in my eye, and then going to the optometrist and being really panicked, and like then the optometrist being like, oh yeah, like sometimes like the gel in your eye just condenses and you get these floaters, and like, oh well, what do we do about that? They're like, ah, you just that's your life now. You just got like floaters in your eye. And I'm just like, oh wow, that's fantastic. I mean, like, they did say, well, like it'll break down over time, and like, yeah, it's like I don't think I have the floater anymore, but like I had this floater for a long time, and like you're just like, oh, I guess this is my life now. And so sort of having that experience presented in this story, I was like, oh, this is super relatable. And then like when it the kind of big scene where it's like, no, like these jellyfish are going to multiply and it's going to get worse, then I was like, oh my God, like that's beyond what I've had to deal with, but it's like, wow, this really, I think, hooked me in because like I was sort of like, oh, I've sort of had a little bit of this experience of the early on part. And then I was like, oh, thank God. Thank God my jellyfish went away.
Yeah, it is pretty scary, like losing your vision. That's of all the things that could happen, like as a cartoonist, that's maybe not certainly not the scariest thing, but it's certainly something I've thought about, like what would happen. And yeah, like I can see that in the character, where if that's what's happening to you, it might feel like this is the end of the world. It's not, but it can feel that way. I can definitely see that.
Yeah, I love like one of my favorite sections or sequences was kind of like the whole grief period that Odette has to go through, you know, like it's a very clear, you know, like denial, anger, bargaining, you know, like it happens stage by stage where when the final diagnosis is delivered and it's like, look, it's gonna progress. It's gonna progress quickly and you're going to be blind. They very quickly their initial reaction to this is like, no, this is not going to happen, you know, like straight into denial. And it's like, I'm going to get healthy, you know. And there's a fun sequence where they're like, they're going to quit cigarettes, they're going to quit drinking, and they're like, they're trying to go for a run, and it's not really the lifestyle they'd been living prior to that, let's say, and not really the lifestyle of their friends, and they are like being a bit of a pest, like, you should stop drinking too, just be healthy, you know? And it's like, what are you talking about?
Yeah, I like that sort of, it's like being in denial almost. Like, well, okay, if I just like quit smoking, quit drinking, my eye's gonna fix itself. You know, I can see that as like a response, for sure.
Yeah, and it makes sense because like modern medicine can do a lot of things, but there's a lot of things it can't do. It can't fix this. It like it has it struggles to understand this. So like you're gonna start grasping for straws.
Yeah, it's a very natural and understandable reaction, and I loved the way it played out, but it was, yeah, it's sad, like I very tragic, and it draws from the author's own life to a certain degree. So Boom went through some medical issues, the details of which are not really for us, but the end result is that she did lose vision in one of her eyes permanently, and
Yeah,
so
it does say that at the back.
yeah.
I read that in the back, and that made a lot of sense because that was one thing I sort of thought reading this was, I was like, wow, like it's interesting to have a cartoonist doing a story about going blind because it's such a visual medium, right? That you're talking about the experience of basically not being able to make or ingest comic books anymore. And I mean, it's a different book, but I almost think it would have been fun to do this as a double feature with the impending blindness of Billy Scott, which is another book I read recently. I think it's a British creator, if I'm remembering right. But that's a story also about an artist. Well, it's a story about an artist that's going blind, and I don't think the going blind is handled as maybe as interestingly as this is handled here in this book, but like that's another one where I'm like, wow, it's like a cartoonist talking about losing your sight, but like it's a sighted medium, right? Like, and it's so interesting. Like, it's an interesting subject matter choice because like visual is such an inherent part of the medium that then you're like talking about cutting out that part. You know, you're doing panels of black now, right? Because like you're trying to convey this experience. I don't know, it's just like it's an interesting choice because the only people that can appreciate the artistry are people that are sighted. People that are blind will not be able to like read it and verify like this is my this is accurate to my experience, you
Well,
know?
not necessarily, Jeff. I think one of the things that I did appreciate about this portrayal is that blindness is not binary. So there is like a huge community of, obviously, there's a huge community of people with vision loss, and it can be progressive, it can be partial. You know, there's people who have pinhole vision, so they can read a book, but only very slowly through like a restricted aperture.
Right.
There's people who have blindness in one eye. So my mother is an artist who is also blind in one eye. And there were a lot of challenges growing up with that that I never thought about, you know, like my mother didn't have 3D vision. My mother, you know, like you couldn't throw something at her, like, hey, catch, you know, like that was not allowed. And my mother couldn't drive at night. So like these restrictions that you live with. So I really appreciated that this progressive vision loss was being shown how even partial sightedness starts to become like a real challenge, and how like even if you're partially blind, you are still very impaired and need to adapt your life to that.
I'm sorry. Yeah, and absolutely. Like, I sorry. I yeah, blindness is not a binary, but it's like it is. And I think it made more sense reading the end where it was like, oh, the author lost vision in one eye. I'm like, oh wow, okay, so this is sort of trying to work through that, and then it's almost like telling the story of an even worse case scenario than what the author experienced, but like still definitely I can tell it's based on that lived experience, right?
Yeah, the emotions definitely ring super, super true. And that's one of the more powerful aspects of this book, I feel. I also really enjoyed how, like, at the very beginning of the work, there's a lot of call outs to visual information that I think, like, even as a visual medium, we're so used to our world being very visually rich with information. But at the beginning, there's like, oh, you know, Odette's like reading six articles or like scanning the price over here, or like, oh, there's like a tabloid and there's some random information over there. And that starts to quiet down, I would say, like as the book progresses. And it's even pointed out that like one of her favorite hobbies, like watching Queer Eye, is not something they can as readily enjoy anymore. Like they can listen to it, but it's not the same.
Right.
Yeah, I hadn't noticed that because I mean, I only read it the one time, but yeah, that's a good catch. I
Yeah.
think you're right. That's deliberate.
Yeah, I enjoyed that opening, which is like looking at the headlines, because that's, I mean, again, I was very much like, oh yeah, I doom scroll on the toilet too.
Even just like checking your phone, like that's going to be a very different experience if you can't see your phone.
Yeah,
Yeah,
you're
but
a
I was
lot
reading.
more reliant on like audio cues and things like that. Even for something as simple as the time.
I didn't pick up on how it sort of shifts, right? Like I know I appreciated the flavor that all the reading provided at the beginning, but I didn't pick up on the fact that, oh yeah, like all that kind of disappears at the end because yeah, what do you can't stare at your phone anymore. I
Well, you
mean,
just had your phone to read, like doomed to you.
I yeah.
There are lots of Doom podcasts. There are several I can recommend.
Oh yeah.
I
I also liked how like the jellyfish increase and increase to a point where you basically can't read the comic anymore, and it just fades into all black pa pages. But then the story kind of picks up again, and there's no jellyfish, but now it's Odette basically blind going through her day to day. And like you sort of see this emphasis on touch. And
Yeah, like I noticed, like at that point, you don't see Odette's face for
yeah,
like
I like
several
that aspect
pages.
as well, where it like it cuts them off at the eyes.
And I think that I don't know, I like that there's that little like epilogue where it's like, okay, we've gone past into the blindness, but now, you know, she's still got a life, she's still existing and going through day to day, you know, making coffee and doing all the things that people do, but just now doing it without sight. But just yeah, I don't know. I like that kind of transition from we've sort of had these jellyfish cluttering things up, and there's sort of like this little epilogue of like life without the jellyfish, but now also life without sight, you know?
Yeah, it feels like silence. It feels like silence in an interesting way. Like it reminds me of accounts I've read of people who go progressively deaf or were born deaf and have like this cochlear implant and like revive some of their hearing ability, and they talk about that silence, you know, of like occasionally like the world gets too much and they're like, I want the silence back.
Interesting.
I don't know. I thought it was kind of interesting in the story when there's the appointment at the ophthalmologist where she gets the news that, like, okay, this is only going to get worse and you're going to go blind. And I really appreciated, like, I thought it was really fantastic cartooning where she's in the office with her friend and she's sitting there blank and her friend is reacting to what the doctor's saying, but you're not hearing any of it. It's just like, it's all visual, right? And I think that was just a really good cartooning sequence, just telling so much with just the way that the panels were constructed, with the way the looks on the faces were. Like, that was just a solid cartooning. But this was, I think that's also where my brain just was like, I was like, man, like, you have to be able to see these pictures to like appreciate this story. Like, there's like an irony in this, you know? Like, but those, that was a great sequence though. Yeah. Really solid cartooning overall.
Yeah, there's also another moment that I really liked where Odette gets the like the cane for the first time and kind of like sweeps it across the panel and the jellyfish get out of the way. Because like while you're using that, you can see, well, see in quotation marks in front of you, the jellyfish don't matter.
Right.
Yeah. I really liked that sequence because it felt like regaining control, regaining
Yeah.
independence.
Like that's the
And
way out of this.
it's another thing that I've read in accounts of people with blindness, how like the cane represents freedom to them. Like, it is like a very important tool for them for navigating the world, and it is something that they really appreciate. And so I liked that sequence of like, nope, Odette's still going to take the metro on their own,
Yeah.
and they're going to navigate it with these tools.
And
I mean,
like, I don't know, fortunate for this fictional character, fortunate for anyone who is in a similar circumstance of like losing their vision gradually so that you have time to adapt. Like we don't see a lot of that in the story necessarily, but as I was reading it, that's something I was thinking about is like, no, you've got time to make plans and like figure out what the next steps are. It's not like a sudden, like the world is just blank and you can't see it anymore.
Another aspect of the book, like the secondary plot, let's say, is the relationship with Odette and Naina, and I enjoyed that as well. I thought they make a really cute couple. They have a really interesting dynamic. I like the way that it unfolds in the story, where it's just like a chance meeting of someone who happens to like Battle Angel Alita, which is another episode that we have done. We also like Battle Angel
They
Alita, so.
also bond over Ranma, so you
Yes,
know.
very good. I'm a huge Ranma fan. Very fun. I mean,
That was really great. There's I mean, I guess because it's not the main plot, we only get to see so much of it, but I feel like there's a lot. Like I want to know as a reader, I want to know more about like their relationship and about Naina and about like what's her deal, because we never really are told. We're told like hints, bits and pieces of something that's going on with her family, but never any details. And like, I mean, it doesn't hurt the story to not have that, because I'm kind of, as I'm reading it, I'm like eager to know more, but also kind of like filling in the gaps in my head. Oh, maybe it's this, maybe it's this. So I mean, it's keeping me reading and keeping me invested in these characters. But yeah, I mean, if that was the goal, it succeeded.
Yeah. I
Yeah.
mean, that actually does remind me that there was like a sequence in here that when they're going out and Naina goes to throw a brick into the grocery store that turns out to be the grocery store her father owns, like Odette is kind of like, what are you doing? Right. And then it just kind of cuts to a flashback where it sort of adds some context and then goes back to, Odette holding her wrist, being like, don't throw this brick into a grocery store. Like, I got it, but like it felt a little like stutter step in terms of like the story pacing. Like, it took me a sec, it took me a beat to be like, oh, like, is this a flashback or did I have a misprinted comic? And I guess I only bring that up as just like a structural thing of like, I understand, like, I don't quite, the storytelling all made sense, but the way that sequence presented itself, it didn't feel smooth, if that makes sense. Like, I'm nitpicking the storytelling, but that's if I had one criticism, that would be my that one page. That's my one criticism.
Yeah, I mean that's fair. I had the same experience as I was reading it. It took me a second to realize, oh, this is a flashback now. I mean, I feel like the events need to happen in that order because Odette hasn't made the connection until that point. So
Yeah.
like if that was in the book earlier, we would be making that connection without Odette going along with us.
Right.
And it might break the momentum. I think, like, one of the interesting aspects of the dynamic between them is that Odette is keeping their creeping blindness secret from Nina. And so, quite often, the dynamic of their relationship is a focus on this conflict with Nina and her parents and her family situation, as nebulous as it may be. And so it almost like throwing a brick, it almost feels like, hey, like the situation is crashing into Odette's life, even though it's been like the subject of their relational conversation. Like Odette's been kind of focused on themselves internally. And you know, they didn't manage to piece this together about someone who is so close to them.
Yeah.
I also found the relationship with Odette and her parents really interesting. Maybe just because I found it a little bit relatable. Of like parents who are like, oh, well, let me do this for you. You can't do that. Let me do that for you. Like, no, I'm an adult. I can do this. And it makes sense then why they have such a hard time accepting help from others later. Even though these are people who should be helping you and you should be accepting that help, like it makes the character make sense. Where like, no, there's a reason for this pulling back of like not wanting help. There's a history to that, and the history makes sense and it's valid, but at the same time, it's getting in the way of you sorting your life out.
Yeah, I think that like that whole sequence with Odette's mom coming in and being, oh, I brought all this food and let me take your laundry and I'll do your laundry for you. Like, and Odette being like, oh, mom, I can do these things for myself. Like, I have not had my parents be overbearing in that way, which is, I guess, I'm lucky, but you know, it also made a certain amount of sense. Like, I'm like, oh, this is a dynamic that I can understand. This like parent that's trying to care, but it's like overdoing it, not letting the kid spread their wings. But yeah, I think that that set up the dilemma so well, because then when Odette's getting so upset and so, I don't know, in a way, unreasonably upset about, you know, people wanting to help her. It's like, yeah, but I get it. I get you're coming from this background where you're always trying to fight to establish your independence. I can do this myself. I don't need anybody else. And then this blindness comes along and it's like, well, shit, now I might have to ask some people to help me sometimes. Like that's a hard, so like in a way, it's like in a way that's harder than the blindness. It's like I have to reach out to other people. I'm gonna have to rely on other people, even though I've established that like I don't need anybody, but like now I do need people, you know? Well,
Also,
we all need people, but you know, we like to tell ourselves we don't.
I think that's a valid perspective, but I think it goes even farther beyond that. So, like, what I read in the mother character is not like trying to care. What I read is trying to impose their will. Trying to impose their vision of how things should be. So, like, whether or not Odette wants their mom coming over unannounced, whether or not Odette wants their mom doing the laundry, they don't have a choice, you know? And they speak about this before where it's like their mom was, you know, constantly on their ass at university because, like, you're going to university and you're going to succeed. Like, this is how it's going to be. And there's no room for an alternative. So, there was no room for Odette to be themselves. And I really liked the sequence of the phone call as well, where it was just like this long stream of words, and it was all about the mom. It was all 100% about like the mom and the minutia of their life, her life, you know, and not really asking anything except to being like, oh, I'm going to set you up with this thing, because again, that's like imposing what it's going to, how it's going to go. So it was, yeah, also something very interesting. I thought it was a well-portrayed dynamic. Let's put it that way.
That was a good comic panel where the dialogue becomes just background texture.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I didn't read any of that. And you're not
No,
supposed to.
no,
That's not listening.
I mean, like, and I, there's a very different context, but man, I have definitely noticed that as my parents have gotten older, we do end up spending a longer time discussing all the different medical issues and things like, oh, now the doctor says I need to do this and da-da. It's like, I think this is just part of aging too.
Yeah, I
But
think so.
I understand that's not actually the point of that scene.
I feel like given that setup at the start of the story, the fact that we never see the parents at the end, like Odette gets help from other people, not her mom.
I thought that
And I
was
feel like that's a victory. Like
yeah.
that's a successful character arc. You have got to a place where the help that you now need is not coming from the place that it is not actually helpful.
Yeah.
Yeah. I thought that was also just a very interesting approach to the story. It felt very real, very human. But it's like, Odette has this big breakdown and lashes out in anger and like pushes Naina away, pushes her friend away. Name I'm forgetting right now, but pushes her
Leo.
friend Theo, pushes Theo away.
Sorry, Leo.
Oh, Leo, sorry. Pushes Leo away, pushes Naina away, and sort of sinks into this depression. And you sort of come into the apartment and there's just garbage and a sink full of dirty dishes and like the mailbox is so full that the mail carrier can't stuff any more letters into the box. Like it's, she spent probably a month just completely mired in depression in bed. And the resolution is just that, like, Leo and Naina show up and come in and are like, okay, like, we're gonna clean up your apartment and we're gonna take care of you. Kind of whether you like it or not, but at that point, Odette is now ready to accept the help, right? And I don't know, there wasn't any big platitudes or big, dialogues between characters. It was just kind of like, okay, you were going through a thing, you got really depressed. We're not giving up on you. We're coming in to help. And then her just being like, okay, yeah. I'm ready to be helped. And I don't know, I just like the simplicity of that resolution, that it's just like all that needed to happen was people needed to just show up and be like, yeah, we're gonna help you out because you clearly need some help. And the character just being finally able to accept it, and instead of continuing to get angry and push back, it's like a simple journey, but like it was a good resolution there. I like that a lot.
Yeah, I love the arc of like the whole book. I felt it was like a really satisfying length. I find that something that's really challenging to nail in like a one-shot graphic novel, but it felt like super, super well done in this case, where
Yeah,
yeah,
like
it
I feel like
ended.
it helps that the book kind of stays on topic. Like it's got a couple of things it's trying to do, and it just like does those things super effectively. Like doesn't beat around the bush. Like you get the whole story. Like it that's the way to write a, let's see, how many pages is this? That's the way to write a 200-page graphic novel.
Very satisfying length.
220 pages,
I rounded off.
Each page is probably a week of work. I
I mean, sure. I know, I'm aware.
don't know.
Right. Is there anything else we want to discuss in the jellyfish?
I mean, I don't know if I have anything specific I want to say about the cartoon. Just that it's really, really good.
I love the ink wash.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's digital. I'm pretty sure it's digital, but it's really, really
Probably.
well executed.
Oh,
There's like
yeah.
lovely texture to it.
Yeah. Like,
Yeah.
I like, we don't, like, there's not a huge number of black and white graphic novels published in North America. At some point, people decided, oh, everything has to be color. But if you're going to do black and white, like this is the way to do it. Like this is how I would do it. Just like gray tones. Gray tones are almost as good as color. You can do whatever you can do with color. You can do most of that with black and white if you use gray
That's so
tones.
satisfying. I love black and white comics.
Well, I mean, I think I've talked about this in a previous episode, but I still subscribe to the theory that black and white comics connect more intellectually with the work and color comics connect more emotionally. So the colors bring up emotional feelings. So the colors inform your feelings as you're reading, where if you take the color away, you're engaging more intellectually with constructing the lines and the words into the story.
That's an interesting idea.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. It'd be a hard thing to measure, but like, I
I
can't see any flaws.
mean, that's I'm cribbing this from some other comic scholar, but I read this somewhere and I was just like, yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. And then I'm sure now someone will be like, ah, oh, how dare you say that you can't make an emotional comic in black and white?
Well, I
That's
mean, you
exactly what
can.
I'm
It's just
saying.
it's a different challenge.
It's highly emotional. I cried.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So then, final thoughts on the jellyfish. Would you recommend?
I would for sure recommend. I want to get more books from Pow Pow Press, because if like this is the quality of work that they're putting out, like I'm missing out if I'm not reading more.
Yeah, no, this is a really, really nice book too. Like, I know I like this more square format, kind of proportion, and just like the watercolor paper texture on the cover. Like, it's just got good production value. And I'm always a big fan of more Canadian small presses existing. And also, I don't know, it's just, I think a lot of Canadian comics I read tend to be set in Toronto or unspecified Ontario towns. So it's nice to have like, this is in Montreal. We've got the Olympic Dome and everything. Like, we are in Montreal here. It's nice.
Right, great. Well, this was my recommendation. I do recommend it very broadly. I think it would be best for teens and up. There's nothing too objectionable, but there are some scenes of nudity. So if you have children, please use your best guidance, I guess. Use your best idea. There's nothing untoward.
My favorite way of phrasing this is, this book acknowledges the existence of sex.
Yes, that's a good way to put it. Yes, that's a very good way to put it. But other than that, like all adult audiences, I think this is a very easy book to enjoy for a wide range of people. And it was very emotionally affecting and very, I'm very glad I read it. That's a lovely story.
It's a good compliment to My Aunt is a Monster.
I was thinking that we got like a, well, we do have a blind theme for Lana.
Yeah, like very different book, very different approach, but like both really interesting.
Oh man, I did not even connect that dot. That's really interesting.
All right, so I guess it's time for shout outs.
I'm JD. I'm going to do a selfish shout out. I'm going to sh shout out Failure to Launch, which is the latest anthology from Iron Circus. I have a story in this. It's all stories about scientific inventions that didn't pan out, or predictions of the future that never happened.
I'm Jeff Ellis, and I'm going to shout out my sister-in-law's mini comic, My Ideas on Sauce. Carmen Zetso is my sister-in-law, and she's been cruising all around every convention imaginable across all of North America. And mostly she's selling stickers and postcards, but this is her first like little floppy mini comic. And so I'm just going to shout out that because I think it's cool for anyone to make a mini comic.
Yeah, very cool. And I'm Jam, and I've been not consuming any media of late. So shout out to Cherry Tomatoes and Harvest Season and
Ooh,
Wyman, I guess.
good shout out.
Oh, I had another shout out. I should just
Take it.
remembered.
Yeah.
Okay, so I was at a this comes with a little story attached to it. I was at a panel. I can't remember the context of this panel. Some it would at some convention or whatever, and someone asked the question to the I think it was a question to the panel at large, but then I was the one who came up with an answer. Like, what can be done to make comics readable to readers who can't see? And this isn't something I'd spent a lot of time thinking about beforehand, but at that time I did realize, oh, WordPress has a built-in plugin. You can just type a transcript into WordPress for your webcomic, and So ever since then, I've been doing that for Phobos and Deimos. Like I've done that for all of Phobos and Deimos. Every page has a transcript so that there is a way for people to read this comic without seeing the pictures. Because like I don't know how else you would do that. I'm not gonna be able to fund an audiobook of my books. Like I don't know how effective like a device would be at reading a comic to you if it's like looking at a physical book, but this handy plugin in WordPress is right there. Yeah, so that's I just think want more people to think about that as a possibility.
Interesting.
Yeah, so what's our next book gonna be, Jeff?
We're gonna do The Thunderbolts by our Kurt Busiek and Mark Bagley.
Okay, and in the show notes we'll put specifically which volumes because this is Marvel
Yes,
Comics and it's hard to figure that out.
I'm going to be doing some research to ensure that we read the same collection with the same floppies in it. And what maybe I'll, if I don't know if we're going to keep this in or not, but if we do, I'll once again plead and beg with Marvel to just consistently put, like, just collect the same books into one graphic novel and don't change it. Don't do three different trades with different collect. This one collects volumes 1 to 15, but then our reprint has volumes 1 to 12. Like, just be consistent. Anyways, just collect it by story arc. That's what you should do.
The Trade Waiters is presented by Cloudscape Comics. We'd like to thank Sleuth for the music. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.